You're listening to Precinct 444, a podcast network from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Today, we're bringing you an episode from Icons, where listeners are introduced to incredible people working within law enforcement who have had a profound impact on the community. These one-on-one interviews provide insight into their lives and careers so we can better understand their challenges and recognize their bravery, commitment, and sacrifice.
As with earlier segments, segment 4 of the story of the FirstNet Authority will outline the ailing problems that faced public safety organizations in the years leading up to the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks, some of which were well known at the time. In this segment, Ed Parkinson and Jim Bugel will provide their perspectives on how FirstNet has forever changed the response of first responders and just how much of a breakthrough it was to partner with established carriers that could handle this important project. And now for segment 4 of the story of the FirstNet Authority.
Ed, thank you so much for being with us. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Hey, Bill.
You know an awful lot about public safety communication, and you've learned it over a number of years, but there was a time when it was all new to you.
Yeah.
When it actually got unexpectedly dropped in your lap. Can you tell us about that?
It was very much a case of the right place at the right time. I was fortunate enough to join the staff of Peter King and my direct supervisor at the time, Heather Hogsett, who went on to have a very successful career with National Governors Association, I think the Business Roundtable and elsewhere. She was gracious enough, I suppose is the way to describe it, to put the public safety communications portfolio in my lap and to learn about Spectrum. And at the time, there was the big international debate regarding LTE versus WiMAX and understanding about P25 and so trunked radios and all these different pieces was a fascinating education. And the best part about the job was working for Peter King, coming from Norfolk and Suffolk County, I was able to be introduced to the NYPD and the NYPD Communications Division, which at the time was led by Chuck Dowd. And going up to New York to visit with Chuck was terrific because, you know, we could see the situations that the NYPD were facing, NYFD, and frankly, public safety around the country. So it was a really good education, really jumping into the deep end. And one that I'm extremely grateful for.
And I recall you telling me in an earlier conversation about this wonderful incident where you're with Chuck Dowd at the top of an escalator at Penn Station.
Yeah, he didn't push me down. Don't worry. It wasn't like that. But it was really, really interesting example of the communications challenges that public safety faced and to largely still face today. You know, we were at the top of the escalators there at Penn Station. And if anyone who knows that part of New York, you just know how chaotic and busy and so on. There's massive construction going on all the time. And Chuck was able to give me an environment where, you know, you could look down and see another NYPD officer, yet they were not able to communicate with each other. And it's just remarkable to think that, you know, here we were, you know, 7-8 years after 9/11, and the communications issues that dogged public safety, not only on that day, but well before and after, still existed. So that was really the catalyst for me to say, wow, there's got to be something I can be part of or help to do just to make public safety's communications just that much better.
And just to underscore one point, the problem with interoperability became clear as something well beyond just New York or Arlington with the Pentagon at 9/11. Sure. Or how did that become glaringly apparent to you?
I just remember time and time again seeing every an incident. I remember one of the first work trips I took on the Homeland Security Committee was to Oklahoma, and there was an enormous F5 tornado that had swept through Moore, Oklahoma. And the problems that they had regarding getting public safety users, emergency vehicles into the disaster area, yet they could not speak to each other. Now, you take that scenario, you take it to a fire, a five-alarm fire, or you take it to an earthquake situation, or you take it, frankly, anywhere where public safety responded to a disaster, to an incident. They weren't able to speak to each other. They didn't have the situational awareness that they needed, not only to protect themselves, but more importantly, protect those people they were going into harm's way to help. And it just didn't make sense to me. I just couldn't understand that. I mean, what we're talking about, sort of 2008, 2009. That's just when companies like Uber were popping up. And wait, you could call a car on your phone and you could see where it is, yet, you know, a 13-year-old had more communications capabilities than a law enforcement professional or an EMT or a firefighter. And it just didn't make any sense to me.
It really is remarkable. And I know that your growth in your understanding was helped along by relationships that you had or developed. And I want to ask you about some of those. First of all, you got to know various people at the major carriers. What were you learning from them?
Yeah, I mean, the teams that they had, not only in DC, but around the country, couldn't have been more helpful. And that goes, you know, Verizon, the T-Mobile team, AT&T, US Cellular, the CSPIR folks down in Mississippi. Everyone was really, really very, very helpful at getting the word out in terms of the capabilities that they can provide in the commercial offerings. And again, remember, when I was learning a lot of this was when LTE was becoming a thing. And, you know, I vividly remember sitting in briefings as a congressional staffer, learning about LTE, learning about the capabilities that were being put out there, and frankly, the art of the possible. And I think that was what was really interesting to me as an individual person, like as a consumer. I could see the capabilities of the power of the American marketplace coming to fruition in commercial offerings like Uber and other things. And it was, for me, the light bulb was, well, if we can do this in commercial world, why can't we do this for public safety? Now it's a much smaller market and so on, but surely we can do better. And that was a really, really telling drive for me when I saw a lot of these incredible technologies being put out into the marketplace, trying to make them applicable to public safety.
And there were important people who shared your vision and your passion about making this available to public safety. And thinking about the Four Horsemen, as they were called, oh, yeah, among others. And we're talking about Chris Moore and Jeff Johnson, Dick Murgon, and Chuck Dowd, who you've mentioned. These were relationships that you were developing with these folks. What were you learning from them?
Yeah, you know, amazing group of people, and you know, the list is exhaustive, yet at the same time, fairly small, about people who saw the art of the possible. And the great thing about the names that you just mentioned all came from different disciplines, different associations, different practices inside public safety. You know, Jeff Johnson from the fire community, Chief Moore out of California and San Jose, you know, just bringing two very, very different examples, one a major metropolitan area, one, although Jeff was out of Portland, still lives in rural Oregon. And that was a really important part. You have Chief Dowd out of New York, right? And my former board chair, Ed Horowitz, is from New York City. And he always likes to say, oh, the rest of the world gravitates and frankly revolves around New York City. But we'll see what he has to say about that after this podcast. But for me, it didn't matter if you were in New York, rural Oregon, Kansas City, where, you know, I spoke to some of the Sprint people. If you were in, you know, I spent a lot of time in Mississippi over the years, down in Vicksburg, all the way out in northern Mississippi in the Delta region, where Congressman Benny Thompson is from. The issues facing public safety when it comes to communications are largely the same. Yes, there are certain things that are very, very focused. Say, Western fires are very different to those we see out east, or major metropolitan areas have a different situational awareness, desires and needs to rural communities. However, communications is still the lifeblood that keeps everyone together and up to speed. So it was this common thread that I could see throughout the community that was just needed to be improved. It needed to be better. It needed to be something that public safety could trust with their lives. And that's the benchmark.
And public safety, just extending that point, needed to be unified, correct? I mean, you had some disparate interests or some wariness on the part of some players in the public safety community, but there was a shared need. What did it take to get everyone unified, everyone on the same page, so that government people would see that, okay, well, public safety is entirely on board, so that's not a disincentive that they're all in disagreement? That must have been heavy lifting, getting everyone on board.
I mean, I think this was really the first time in perhaps the history of public safety when it comes to unifying around a message that they needed to go to Capitol Hill on or develop a real movement around, where every discipline was aligned around a single idea. And at the time, it was the simple message of reallocating the D block to public safety. And, you know, it was simple. I mean, D-block, it doesn't get much simpler than that. You can put it on a pin. You can put it in a message. It's something everyone can really understand. And that was a remarkable thing. It took a lot of time. It took a lot of effort. It took a lot of, you know, the expression herding cats is probably highly applicable in this situation. But it took leadership. And I think folks like Harlan McEwen and the four chaps you mentioned and, you know, Bill Schreier out of Seattle played a role. And that's, I think, the wonderful thing about this. There was leadership from the public safety community. There was leadership from the associations. There was leadership, too, from the carriers around this need and this acknowledgement that something needed to be done. I'm not saying everyone was on board, for sure. There were certainly other interests at play. That being said, the critical mass and, frankly, this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that was before public safety at that time when the reallocation of the D-block movement was working its way across the country and through Congress was a pretty amazing thing to, you know, be part of.
And I want to make sure we give proper due to a champion of FirstNet that you're very familiar with, and you've mentioned him, Representative King. Mm. He initiated legislation that became a catalyst, correct?
Yeah, I mean, he was... He took a risk, and the staff director at the time, Rob O'Connor, they took a risk on, as you can hear, this one kid who grew up in South Africa who had no business being in Washington, D.C. at the time. And I think my ignorance played a lot to the eventual success I had. You know, they took a chance on me to be part of the team. And really, you know, my staff director too later on, Mike Russell, they let me go and do what I thought what I needed to do. I mean, there'd be weeks at a time where I'd pop in the mornings to the office, and then I was out trying to get co-sponsors to the legislation that Pete King introduced. I can't remember the name. I think it was 5081 or something like that. And the fact that they just let me go and do what I needed to do, knowing that I'd have Pete's best interests at heart, public safety's best interests at heart, they deserve a lot of credit, for putting their faith in me and allowing me to know that I couldn't screw up. That was the line.
And let's put the spotlight on another person who you were shoulder to shoulder with, Jessica Rosenworcel.
Well, I mean, there's no one, I think, who deserves more credit for the passage of the FirstNet legislation than Senator Rockefeller. But of course, Jessica Rosenworcel, John Branscombe, Sean Bone, you know, these were people who they knew that this was the right thing to do. And, you know, Jessica has now obviously got an incredible career. That she's the chair of the FCC, and there's no one more deserving, in my opinion. But she really was the main person who got S-911 as the legislation that Senator Rockefeller introduced and ultimately became the FirstNet legislation. She was the one who really lent in. And, just an amazing person.
So FirstNet is created through this act of Congress. Mm-hmm. And sort of like the dog who's been chasing a car and suddenly you catch it, what do you do with it? You're sitting there thinking, okay, well now, how do we build a $40 billion program? You had, I'm trying to think of the name, I know you were the third employee.
Right.
And I recall that you were talking to a colleague of yours and saying, how are we going to do this?
Yeah.
Maybe you can take us up on that story.
I was very fortunate. So, when the legislation passed at the beginning of 2012, it was very much a case of, you know, what next? And according to the statute, the board had to be created, it subsequently did. And then in 13, I was fortunate enough to join. And my first day, I still remember it was July 31st, 2013. And Uzamu Nije was the first staffer. Christy Wild was number two. And then TJ Kennedy and I started on the same day. And TJ at the time, I think, was the assistant general manager. But we walked into our office the first day after orientation, and there was one laptop between the two of us, cockroaches running around the office, a couple holy couches, and sort of looked at him like, okay, what now? And TJ was great because he was able to say, look, you can't think of this in terms of the number or the scale, because if you do that, this will never get done. You've got to break this down into chunks. You've got to think about, okay, well, what are the three things we need to do this week? What's the apparatus we need to do? What's the structure that we need to build in order to then get to the next phase? And I think he was very, very good at, certainly for me, because I dealt with him a lot, at how do we hire? How do we put together the structure of payment system? And You know, the team, Larry Strickling was the administrator, beg your pardon, of NTIA, the assistant secretary at NTIA, and he deserves a lot of credit. He really let TJ and the board do what they needed to do, and for us to go. And look, I mean, it's like anything. We weren't even teenager at the time. We were probably, using the analogy of growing up, we were probably single digits. And it was definitely, as we internally christened it, sort of the Wild West times of FirstNet. And we definitely did not bat 1,000. I mean, no one does. I don't even think we batted at 500. But we made progress. And 2013, onboarding people, starting to pull together the two swim lanes that we needed to do, which was put an RFP, get together, build an RFP, and consult with public safety. And the consultation with public safety was crucial, because without their input, how could we say that this was public safety's network? So those two areas were the ones that TJ really made sure we stayed laser focused on. And it was an interesting time.
Yeah, in the past, you've laid out the different steps, the challenges, and you've said, this was difficult, but it was easy compared to doing this, yeah. Which was easy compared to doing that. Can you walk through those steps?
Yeah, I mean, I remember Rich Reed, who came from DHS. He and I had known each other for a long, long time. And when he first came on, he's like, wow, this is going to be tough. But then the next thing we're going to have to do is going to be even harder. And Jeff Bratcher, who is the CTO at the organization, has been there a long time. You know, these are really, really capable people. And there's so many others more than I can name. But it was almost like, well, consultation with public safety to get their input, to put that into the RFP, that was really hard. I mean, Dave Buchanan, Amanda Hilliard, Jeremy Zolo, these people were leading the charge to do that. That was really hard. But then writing the RFP, that was even harder. Or putting the math together around that. Matt Schiller, John Quinlan, James Mitchell, all of these people. But then getting the RFP on the street, getting it through the federal process. I mean, that was so hard, but that was easy compared to what we did before. Oh, and then awarding an RFP. There was a protest and there were downsides and the protest. Eventually that went through its process and the legal team working with DOJ, an incredible amount of work. Well, that was easy compared to what we did before. And then you have to then onboard with AT&T who won the bid, pulling together the cultures of the federal government plus a Fortune 10 company. I mean, that in itself was another challenge. So each phase was brutal, but easy compared to the thing that had to follow it. And again, I made a comment about being ignorant earlier in the conversation. I think had we known how hard this would be, we would never have started. And that, I think, is one of the fortunate accidents of history that we now find ourselves in when looking at the success of the program as it is today.
And among the challenges, if I'm correct, is that none of the Republicans on the Committee of Jurisdiction were on board at all.
Yeah. You know, my friend David Reddle is, we laugh about this now. He was the main lead at the time. And, you know, David, one of the smartest people I know, he was the guy who over at NTIA when he was the assistant secretary who made me part of the team that made me the acting CEO. So I owe David a lot. But when we were congressional staffers, he would not let me even anywhere near anything to do with the communication because we were out of jurisdiction in the Homeland Security Committee. And if anyone knows anything about Congress, it's all about jurisdiction. And I'm going to butcher this, but John Dingell had a fantastic line about energy and commerce. It's like, If it's on the ground, it's energy. If it's in the air, it's commerce or something like that. So their jurisdiction was mile wide and mile deep, and rightly so, they fought very hard for that. So, me convincing Pete King to introduce the legislation pleased a lot of public safety, and it made me a pariah inside of the halls of Congress to a large degree. But I mean, to give them their credit though, too, eventually Greg Walden came around, became a huge supporter of the program. David, you know, when he was head of NTIA, couldn't have been more supportive, not only to me, but also to the program. And I think like anything in time, when you're in the heat of battle or in the heat of the moment and you're on the opposite side of a table, you're gonna clash heads, and that's unavoidable. Thankfully, we were proved right on the public safety side, and you know, you can see now when we sit here in where we're in October 2022, 4 million users on the network. I mean, doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah, you've cleared a lot of high hurdles, and unquestionably, FirstNet has been extremely successful. I want you to comment, if you would, on four achievement areas that were probably thought unlikely at one point. First, the growth in terms of user adoption.
Well, you hope that this is going to be a case of if you build it, they will come. But you never can be sure. And again, if you recall the comment I made earlier, this is a resource that public safety have to trust with their lives. They have to know that they can rely on this service with their lives. And that's a pretty high standard. And so the early days were tough. I recall, I mean, I'm on the authority side, I wasn't part of any sales efforts, but you know, we would hear from public safety in the field, it's like, well, why would I adopt that? You know, AT&T's coverage sucks out here. And I, you know, knowing the folks at AT&T, that was a really, really tough bar to reach. However, they got it right. They adopted their program of lighting up the band 14 spectrum with additional spectrum that they had, and they were able to massively improve the service levels that they had, plus cover parts of the country now that there was no coverage before. And so that's why you see this hockey stick curve in terms of adoption across the country. And like anything, if it's worth doing it, you got to do it right. Plus, usually the right things to do are a little harder than the easy things to do. So it took a hell of a commitment from their side. So that's, I think, why you saw adoption slowly to begin with. There were some true believers in what we were trying to achieve. There were those early adopters who were able to show us, well, that's working great, that's not working great. The field team at the authority, we were able to then speak to public safety with that unvarnished non-vendor perspective that they were able to give us. And I think that too shows the importance of the authority, ensuring that we were holding AT&T accountable to meet the benchmarks we put out there, plus also ensuring the voice of public safety never ever left the network. So credit to AT&T. You know, they heard from us, they heard from public safety, and they switched gears a couple of times to get it right. And that's why you see the numbers that you see today.
And to build on that a little bit, there was a significant, highly unusual cultural change within AT&T.
Well, you speak about, people talk about the bureaucracy of the federal government, which is a very, very true thing. But yeah, I mean, how do you take a company that I don't know what AT&T has, 230,000 people working in its company, something like that. And that is an extraordinarily huge organization. But, you know, John Stankey, John Donovan, Randall Stevenson, you know, these people deserve a lot of credit because they made the FirstNet program an indelible part of the culture of AT&T. So much so when I was fortunate to go and visit their headquarters in Dallas a couple of times, you know, you could see the pride that came with being part of the FirstNet program. I mean, this was making a difference outside of, you know, the Wall Street conversation, or whatever. This was having a tangible difference to the men and women of this country. And I think that's an incredible testimony to the leadership over at AT&T. They saw the commercial benefits of this, but they also saw the impact that this is going to have on the men and women of public safety, plus the impact it'll have on saving lives and helping communities. So that was a really, really important realization for them from a cultural perspective. And you see it today. You can go, I think, into any AT&T store and you can see the, you know, purchase your FirstNet program here. And that radiates today when just this last terrible hurricane down in Florida, Hurricane Ian, where I think Governor DeSantis said there were more responders and emergency responders to Hurricane Ian than at any time since 9/11. And FirstNet was there and are still there today.
And yet another achievement, which again was not a given, is the transformation of a very skeptical public safety community into true believers. Isn't that accurate to say?
Yeah. And, you know, I remember the conversations that our field team would have all the time, you know, in the early days, especially. Actually, I remember there was this one conversation, my former general counsel, Stuart Kopinski, and I were at a conversation at the FCC, and there was this gentleman out of King County who, after hearing our initial presentation, I think this is late 13 or early 14, he said, "I bet you $1 million that this will never get up and running." And I think it was about 2018, 2019, I saw that gentleman again, and of course, completely denied having the saying those words. But yeah, I mean, there were conversations with folks across the country, respectfully, some harder than others, who would say, I mean, this is a complete joke. Just don't. This is never going to happen. Just please leave. Yet it's those people, and I vividly know hundreds of these individuals who have come up to me afterwards and said, yeah, I was very skeptical that this was going to work. I didn't think you'd be able to pull it off. And, you know, it's pretty amazing. And they are now becoming some of our biggest evangelists. And yeah, but that's also public safety. In terms of public safety, the community is absolutely amazing. They're able to take so little and do so much with it. And I think they have been fed a bunch of pack of lies in the past, not so much in communications, but in a variety of different areas. And rightly so, the skepticism is high. And that is also one of the things. If you win over public safety, if you earn their trust, and that's a really important phrase, earn, then they will go march the hills for you. And I think this is where what we did right, certainly at the FirstNet Authority, is by putting public safety first, right? We didn't put AT&T first. We didn't put anyone else first. We put the voice of public safety first. And I think that was super important. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why you now see so many true believers, so many evangelists of the FirstNet system out there.
And no small part of the FirstNet story is that it continues to evolve, continues to innovate, continues to adapt when different situations are learning experiences. I want to ask you about something that I heard you talking about in another presentation, and it was about how even the COVID pandemic revealed to FirstNet what it was capable of and stretched it in certain ways.
Yeah, it's remarkable. The way there was an analogy we used in the early days of FirstNet, which was think about how you use the internet 10 years ago versus how you use the internet today. Well, think about how it's going to be used in the future. And just even boarding an airplane where you used to print off your, you know, your paper ticket, and now who does that? And I think that's the thing about FirstNet. At the time when we were first rolling it out, it was going to be, you know, mobile devices, data flow, some voice. And maybe that's what we were thinking. That'd be great. But now, and the team at AT&T and the strategy team and the roadmap team at the authority deserve a lot of credit. There is this entire roadmap looking down the line in not just being a fast follower of commercial technologies, but being at the cutting edge of what those are to ensure that public safety get that next step, get that next generation at the same time that commercial purposes, commercial markets have it. So this goes beyond applications. This goes beyond hardware and software. This goes into the ecosystem that is now existing. I was just at the IACP conference last week. Shout out to Vince Tolucci and the team at IACP, remarkable group of people. I was blown away by what that floor looked like. Now, remember, you mentioned COVID. That was the first show in 2 or 3 years, and I'd been at pretty much every show in the lead up to that. That floor was basically a technology showcase. That was not the case 2 or 3 years ago. And to your question, Bill, COVID, I think, has really pushed the envelope where we thought maybe in my world now, 911, we thought about, we knew pre-COVID that everyone had to be in the ECC day in, day out. Well, that's not the case anymore, right? You're talking about being able to have your telecommunicators answer their devices at home. COVID really lent into the need for technology and for technological innovation to come to the marketplace. It's one thing developing in a lab, you've got to get it out in the field to protect people and to serve communities better. Community policing, that's another big piece in how technology will help, and FirstNet is helping that. And I think COVID really, really showed the need for advancement in technology and for the adoption of the technology in the field. So it's pretty amazing to see. I mean, I know the FirstNet system during COVID was double the amount of data was used just on the FirstNet system during COVID than pre-COVID. Just proof is in the pudding right there.
I loved hearing you say in an earlier conversation we had that the great thing is that FirstNet is now the baseline, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of standards, capabilities, expectations. That's a remarkable journey from being the laggard, the industry that couldn't keep up with the 13-year-old
Well, I mean, when you think about it, it's just in four or five short years. I think FirstNet now has about 4 million connections. US Cellular is, and this is October 2022, US Cellular has about 4.9 million. So soon, FirstNet's going to be the fourth largest carrier in the United States. And that's an amazing thing to say in, again, a very short period of time. So it's remarkable, but I think it's also testimony to the fact that there was this vacuum out there in the marketplace. And kudos to all those people who were involved in making FirstNet what it is today.
So we're talking about the many achievements and successes, and rightly so. What are the hazards that are ahead? What are the challenges that you want to make sure FirstNet faces so that it can maintain this momentum?
Well, I think the fact that it's become very apparent that there's this being this extreme need, and you're going to see true competition in the public safety marketplace right now is actually a good thing, right? Because yes, FirstNet was partnered with AT&T, but our real focus was on public safety. And so if you're seeing true competition, better public, better service, cheaper devices, all of that above, plus everything else, how's that not a good thing for public safety? And that was always our core focus there. I know that the program has to be reauthorized in Congress and the spectrum has to be relicensed. So those are two sort of immediate challenges that, and there'll be opposition to that, of course, given the success of the program. But it's about then building upon the success where it is now. I think that if the program just remains a data voice network, then yes, it has fulfilled the needs of Congress, but it won't really take advantage of the incredible opportunity that exists right now. So I think that there's an amazing opportunity for the FirstNet Authority and for AT&T and public safety to really think about, well, what is the art of the possible in a 5G ecosystem and then down the line in a 6G ecosystem? How can better feature sets, better technological innovation be adopted in the FirstNet system? And, our former board chair, Tip Olsen-Taylor, he was always talking about the need for constant innovation. Sue Swenson, another board chair, she was always talking about the need for evolution. And if you sit still, the minute you think you're good, then that's when you get taken out. And I think, the authority, certainly under Steve Benjamin, the current board chair, is in the fortunate position where they're able to now think about what does the next thing look like and how do they provide that type of service to public safety. So all the foundation is there for the program to continue to grow and continue to evolve. And I have little doubt that they'll be able to do that.
A final question for you, Ed. I know that in the world of public safety, the firm belief is it's never about me. It's about public safety writ large, the people we serve. Having said that, I do want to ask you this question. What are you most proud of in terms of your contribution to the development and success of FirstNet?
Oh, wow. For me, it's actually being part of something far bigger than myself. The friendships I've made along the way, the competitive acknowledgments of at the time competitors and whatnot, but we can now sit back and talk about those times with mutual respect. Being part of something that's going to far outlive me, not just here, but also seeing the global reach that this is having. That's also pretty exciting to see. There are about 20 other countries who are looking to deploy FirstNet type systems, and they're looking at us as the model. I think the legacy is going to be, the lives saved and the communities protected and the difference it's going to make to public safety, knowing that, their lives are a little bit easier, a little bit safer, and the communities that they protect are a little bit safer. That for me will be, to be part of something like that is pretty amazing.
Well, we owe you and all those who helped launch FirstNet a real debt of gratitude. And I want to thank you for being here today and sharing your insights.
Thanks, Bill. No, I appreciate it. It's great to be here. And before we wrap up, I do want to just say the FirstNet Authority is a pretty amazing group of people. And the AT&T team, rightly so, they're the ones out there doing the selling, doing the construction, doing the the a lot of the heavy lifting. But the authority is pretty remarkable. And a lot of people are there. A lot of people have gone through the ranks, and there'll be others joining it. So keep an eye on the team over there. They're a great group of people. Lisa Casillas is the current acting CEO. But it takes a village, doesn't it? And the nice thing about this program is there's not a single one person who overshines the other. It really is that collective effort. So to everyone who's played a role, it's wonderful to be part of a friendship group and a FirstNet family.
Very good. Thank you again.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you for listening to segment 4 of the Story of the FirstNet Authority, part of the Precinct 444 podcast of the National Law Enforcement Museum. You just heard from Ed Parkinson, and here to conclude segment 4 is Jim Bugel.
Jim, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Bill.
Now, you've held high-level positions at the nexus of public safety and national security. How far back in your career and in your experience did you see and understand this huge problem which FirstNet ultimately addressed?
Well, Bill, I recognized it early on. It's been a challenge since the advent of public safety communications, but it really came to the fore in 9/11 with the New York response and the Washington, D.C. response by the first responders, and their lack of interoperability or a common communications platform obviously was a preventable cause of a lot of loss of life, especially in New York with FDNY firefighters. Those that were in the tower expressed saying, get out of the tower, and firefighters actually ascending into the tower.
Talk to us a little bit about the nature of the communication between public safety entities prior to and up to and through 9/11. There wasn't this interoperability. What was it like?
So it was narrowband communications. When I say narrowband communications, it was the walkie-talkie, push to talk, voice only, no multimedia that we now come to every day of our lives. It was very, very rudimentary. And I think it was really came to light in a Senate hearing in 2009, maybe 2010, where then Police Commissioner Ray Kelly was asked the question by a senator, why do you need a broadband communications network? And he responded, because the average 14-year-old has more capability than my officers on the street.
That's telling.
That's very telling.
That's very telling. But I assume, and I believe from an earlier conversation with you, I got the strong sense that you saw problems well before 9/11. I mean, there were probably all sorts of incidents, events that showed there should have been the kind of coordination that there wasn't. Was there a certain sense of, gee, guys, I told you so, when the 9/11 happened or any of the other incidents? I mean, was it kind of a lonely voice for a while?
It was a lonely voice. If you were in a municipality and the fire department couldn't communicate with the police department or the ambulance service, it was just kind of a standard operating practice that was clearly an annoyance, an obstruction to efficient delivery of government to citizen services. But it was the way the system was built. In a lot of cases, it's designed, and it took money and initiative to fix. Some communities recognized it as a problem and tried to merge the networks to get more cross-service functionality. Some were successful, some were not. But then again, we were still talking about just narrowband communications. So when you look at, do you put a lot of money into fixing just narrowband communications, or do you actually make the investment to transform from a legacy technology to the new multimedia technology?
I assume also, in addition to that technology shift that you were pushing for, you also went up against cultures that weren't used to working together and maybe were disinclined to work together, you know, police, fire, whoever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, you know, if you look at this whole thing, there's kind of three elements to it. Number one, there's the functionality. Number two, it's going from narrowband to broadband. And then number three, there's actually the investment. And if you look at the way the narrowband or land mobile radio networks were designed, it was designed in what economists call heavy iron model, right? The municipality had to buy a tower, put the antennas on it, staff the maintenance and refreshment of the technology. They owned it. They owned it from A to Z, which public safety liked because they were in total control. They weren't dependent on any supplier. But as those models and these systems became so big, they became onerous and they became very expensive for the municipalities. And you're seeing it now. You're seeing what's happening is we're kind of past that tipping point where in the using the current economist terminology, the SaaS model as a service. And so they're able to, number one, get frontline technology, not legacy technology, but the most advanced technology. They're able to buy what they need, not have to worry about the capital investment of towers, maintenance, technology refreshment, all the stuff that comes along with that, and they can expand it or contract it as they need it. So this really a new economic model that's been brought into a basically a owner's model into as a service model.
A lot took place to get to that point, and you were involved in a lot of those phases. So I want to delve into that a bit. I know you were on a number of federal committees.
Yep.
How did that come into play in terms of pushing along what became FirstNet?
So that's interesting because as we just started this interview, the problem existed. It was a known problem. It was something that people were trying to address. But when you look at 9/11, you look at Katrina, you look at all these other large scale natural or man-made disasters, the same issues came back. Response was impaired by lack of interoperability amongst the many services, amongst the many jurisdictions and mutual aid partners. And so as Congress and the White House and others convene these fora to examine this issue, it all came back to the same issue. It all came back to communications and that the responders could be incredibly more efficient. More importantly, they could be safer. And even more importantly, they could actually be more responsive with advanced communications. And so in every one of these advisory groups and I guess advisory groups is the best word for it, the answer came back, look, we need to change the overall approach to this. And we need to provide our first responders in this country with advanced communications, multimedia advanced communications, secure and a dedicated network as opposed to a legacy technology that is not dedicated.
Which would seem to be an obvious conclusion, and yet I know there was resistance among certain legislators or federal entities. What was that about?
Public safety had been communicating with narrowband land mobile radio for almost 60 years. And the resistance of changing that model was strong, very strong. It going back to something I said earlier, public safety, as you well know, has lives on the line. And they don't want to leave anything to chance. They do not want to experiment with new technologies. They don't want to experiment. They are hesitant to experiment with new technologies. They want to go with things that are proven, because at the end of the day, first responders' lives and citizens' lives are at the end of the line, and you don't want to put that in jeopardy. So they, if you look at cellular communications or commercial cellular services that we all know, that began in 1984. And it was basically voice communications. And then we had 1G and then 2G, where we started getting texts and photos. And then with the advent of the smartphone in 2006, 2008 time, we got into true multimedia, right? Text, video, voice, and data. So basically, as you look at this, that transition took a while, because public safety wanted to own and operate their own networks, because that's how they had always done it. That's how they felt most secure. That's what they had the highest level of confidence in. And they were hesitant to turn that over to a partner, because they wanted to be served the way that they needed to be served, and they needed that trust.
So sticking with your approach to the government and the support you needed from important government folks, were there specific key dominoes that needed to fall for the others to fall in line? Did you get key support that you would point to as pivotal?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you look at what happened, what Senator McCain, Senator Biden, when he was in the Senate, and then when he was vice president, their support was instrumental in pushing this through. And if you really look at this, this came out of 9/11. So it started in a Republican administration. The legislation was created, in essence, by the biggest supporter, Senator Rockefeller, which was a Democratic administration, and then awarded, again, back in the Republican administration. So the leadership there was incredible, and it was instrumental to getting it done and keeping it on track. Remember, so this went through several administrations and several Congresses before it got passed.
Am I right in thinking it took the weight of government support to convince the commercial networks to get on board?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you look at this as a, I'll tell you the way we look at it. We look at this as a moonshot. I mean, the equivalency of the Apollo moonshot is what this is, right? Because we're taking a commercial wireless business, we're creating a completely separate network that has its own band of spectrum, its own performance characteristics, priority and preemption, a security level that's beyond the commercial networks, and who's capable of doing that? Well, if you look across the landscape, there's five companies that are probably capable of doing that. There's probably others that are capable of doing that. Requires tremendous investment, tremendous technological wherewithal, but also requires the baseline network to do this with. So when you look at something like this, you say, is it an opportunity or is it an obligation to serve our country? Because if we don't make this investment and pursue this for our nation's first responders, there's no city that can do. New York can't do this on their own. New York and LA combined can't do this on their own. Public safety couldn't do it on their own individually. They just don't have the financial horsepower to do it. wireless broadband communications, as with all broadband communications, scales. And so you have to have the users, the network, in order to scale it to make it incrementally less expensive for everybody that uses it. So you're looking at that equation of providing a service that's needed with unique service capability for the first responders at a reasonable price. And you have to combine the economies in order to make that happen. To say, oh, we're going to go out and build you your own network and we're going to put 4 million, let's just say 4 million users on it, but we're going to go and build you an $80 billion network. Well, that's not going to be that affordable on a monthly basis. So you had to combine, you had to use the market or the power of the marketplace, which is commercially available handsets, commercially available equipment, so you can spread it over a number of different customers, but then apply a special quality of service to the FirstNet user.
I have to believe you must have felt like a ping pong ball at times with the public safety entities not trusting the reliability of commercial networks, with the commercial networks saying, hey, this isn't how we make money. And by the way, we're not giving up bandwidth.
Right. Absolutely. So when I first approached public safety about a public-private partnership model, where we used the balance sheet of a private enterprise and gave public safety the economic advantages of that, of the embedded investment, that they don't have to go out and build brand new, that they can basically leverage the investment that's already in the ground, and we could apply special services like priority and preemption and network resiliency, which they required. Those were long, heated discussions. There was a perceived network reliability issue on behalf of public safety. There were doubts or concerns that we would actually be able to cut out a section of the network and give them priority and preemption on a consistent basis, on a always on basis. So there was a lot of reservation, but there was a lot of discussion. And this is where I've got to really applaud the other members that were involved here, because many of them were resistant, but we had to go out and prove it to them, number one. And number two, once they understood what was possible, they became advocates for it. And they understood that you had to have the economics. Congress was not going to fund a nationwide standalone network. You had to do it with existing infrastructure in some way possible. And that's how we came up with the public-private partnership.
Wasn't the big breakthrough with the realization that public safety had something of value that commercial networks needed, meaning bandwidth?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When Congress allocated the 20 megahertz of bandwidth, that was the game changer, right? Because the priority and preemption that you put on the network was then statutorily, that quality of service was statutorily guaranteed for public safety. It wasn't, well, we'll do it when we best can, we'll do it when it's available. It was the band 14, the 20 megahertz at 700, was statutorily reserved for public safety, and that it could be utilized when public safety was not utilizing it. However, whenever public safety needed it, those civilians would be moved off of it immediately.
And there were dynamics at play. I know in an earlier conversation with you, and I want to share this with the listeners because I was so intrigued by it, you said there was a perfect intersection of things that opened up the possibilities. And you mentioned, of course, the narrowband and broadband, but you also talked about the economics at the time and the development of applications. That perfect intersection is very intriguing. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the FirstNet program has been wildly successful by any measures. I mean, if you look at it, 20 megahertz of spectrum being put to full operating capability in less than 4 years, actually less than 3 years, 4 million plus connections on it, faster than any other thing's been built in the wireless industry in this country. And quite frankly, unique around the world. I mean, there's a lot of countries that are trying to understand how this was done and how they can replicate it. But the environment of, number one, the narrowband communications actually becoming more expensive as opposed to becoming less expensive. Digital natives, we have, you know, basically your first responders now grew up with smartphones. And then last but not least, all of the ancillary applications and functions that come along with wireless broadband communications. And that leads to paperless traffic tickets, paperless reports, paperless scheduling, all sorts of efficient uses that allows public safety to utilize their very precious personnel for response and less for administrative duties.
As successful as it's clearly been, speaking of FirstNet, isn't it also an ongoing challenge that public safety and the commercial networks have a very different take on sharing technology?
Yes, they do. They absolutely do. It is a very unique marketplace. If you're providing broadband communication services to the financial sector, the transportation sector, name the other sectors, those private companies are competing vigorously against each other, and they look at technology and technology advancement as their market advantage for the period that they can maintain it. Public safety, on the other hand, shares like no other sector I've ever seen, and they're proud to do it. And the reason for that is because they don't really have any backstop. There's nobody really advocating for them and their technology. If you look at the narrowband world, it was the police department or the fire department with their vendor. There was really nobody in there. With the FirstNet Authority, they have a government agency that is guaranteeing and managing the expectations of the statute and the contract to deliver reliable service with the performance requirements that are needed. And so basically the public safety entity looks at it as, this is what we're getting. We're contracting with AT&T. However, we know that the FirstNet Authority, the government agency, is maintaining the network to perform as required.
Another challenge we haven't discussed is the fact that you have to get states, localities, municipalities, even down to tribal governments, cooperating and adopting.
Right.
It sounds like there's been a lot of success in that direction, but that there's more to come.
Well, if you, I don't know if this ever came out before, but there's a requirement in the law, and the law said that all 50 states and 7 territories had to affirmatively opt in to the program. Now, as we discussed earlier, this has transitioned through many congresses and administrations before it came to fruition. But again, go back to the 2011-2012 timeframe, and we're in the shadows of the Affordable Care Act, right? And so Congress wanted to make sure that it didn't fall into that same problem of we are establishing a nationwide public safety broadband network, and we're forcing it onto the states. They wanted to eliminate that. So they put a requirement in that all states had to affirmatively opt in, which quite frankly was a blessing. The reason it was a blessing was because the FirstNet Authority went and did a tremendous amount of research about what was needed, and the regional requirements and local requirements of what should be in a network and what the performance characteristics of the network should be. So when we went out to go after the award to opt in, we met with every one of these states multiple times and territories, and basically worked with them on what they wanted to see in the network. And that has, number one, it was a tremendous education opportunity to explain to the states that you are spending millions of dollars on land mobile radio for your first responders at the local level, at the state level, and there is an opportunity to provide them with wireless broadband communications at significantly lower rates with more capabilities, and that, in essence, things are moving to broadband. And what would you like to see in the network in terms of coverage and everything like that? So in a lot of states, it really helped with the adoption. They said, this is fantastic. You're deburdening us, you're helping us, you're moving us to a new technology. This is fantastic stuff. And that has led to the success and the speed at which we've been able to put connections and people on the network.
And just to make clear, one of the advantages to municipalities is they're not having to float bonds anymore to finance radio technologies that then become obsolete and more expensive to upgrade.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And basically, to your point, not having to float bonds to just upgrade a legacy technology. It allows them to invest in other areas, you've nailed it. So,
lessons are learned, of course, at every stage, and I'm guessing it, even during the COVID crisis, there were lessons learned that have helped FirstNet evolve and adapt and adopt to situations that maybe they hadn't foreseen.
Right, you're absolutely right. I've been in this business for a long time, and I've always held this belief: if we provide public safety with a reliable, secure, preemptible priority service, they will figure out ways to use it that we never thought of as a commercial carrier. And that is exactly what happened, and that came through in the pandemic. If you look at the traditional public safety mission of law enforcement, medical services, and fire services response, that was completely changed during the pandemic. FirstNet was instrumental in setting up testing centers, temporary hospitals, virtual visits by doctors, on and on and on. And it was one of our busiest times in the entire program. We worked closely with all the major municipalities as they were setting up their testing centers, then their vaccination centers, then their temporary hospitals, along with the Corps of Engineers, DHS, Army Corps of Engineers, and DHS, and others across the nation. And quite frankly, it was a very busy time for us because medical, doctors, nurses, it was fundamental. And I'll give you a perfect example of this. When the testing centers opened up, take the New Jersey area, for example, or LA, there would be a queue of cars that were miles long with two, three individuals in that car waiting for hours to go through the testing center. What are they doing? They're watching Netflix. They're doing email. They're doing text, so on and so forth. The very service, that basically the medical staff is using the network too, right? To put test, identification, medical records, so on and so forth. FirstNet was instrumental in rising above all that other traffic, all that commercial traffic, all those commercial networks that were just getting pounded. FirstNet was able to provide the broadband capacity and speed of service that was needed for them to conduct their business, which in a lot of cases, obviously, was very data intensive and required speed. And so another example was hospital ship, I believe it was the Comfort, sailed into LA Harbor, and it needed communications. Well, there's two ways to do that. You pull fiber to a ship, or you put FirstNet on the ship and on the ground. And we did both. But again, just a unbelievable example. I am absolutely convinced that this nation's response to COVID was drastically improved by FirstNet and its capabilities.
And there are other recent examples, aren't there? I have to think that FirstNet was quite prominent and helpful with fighting wildfires out west. We had Hurricane Ian come through.
Yeah.
Those must have been situations that proved the worth of FirstNet.
It proved the worth of FirstNet, and it's also a good demonstration. I'm glad you brought that up. It's a good demonstration of how AT&T, the FirstNet Authority, has responded to the needs of public safety. With wildfires, for example, wildfires by definition are in wild lands, generally unserved areas by land mobile radio, by cellular coverage. They don't have capacity or coverage and capacity. So what we've done, we had what's considered what we call response operations group, where we can actually take a mobile cell site and move it into an unserved area, or where the area is damaged, where the infrastructure is damaged, while we're recovering and restoring the service. But the one thing that public safety wanted, they said, look, we need a very rapid response in these wildfire areas, very rapid. We need that deployable network asset to come in very quickly. But here's the catch. It also has to move very quickly because the fire line changes. Now, disasters are different. You see a hurricane coming, you got a couple of days prepare. Tornadoes hit without announcement, but once you move in, everything's pretty much static. Wildfires, different because everything's moving around. So in cooperation with public safety, we developed what we call the compact rapid deployable, which is basically a small cell site that's about the size of 2 foot lockers stacked on top of each other with wheels. That's deployable with a pickup truck. But here's the real unique thing. If you would have said or asked the question 5 years ago, 4 years ago, would a commercial carrier ever let a subscriber or a customer adhere to the network without approval or notification, would a carrier do that? The answer is no, we wouldn't do that. There's a number of reasons for that. However, working with public safety, we discovered the urgent need for this capability, the ability to move quick and self-provision, in essence. We developed the compact rapid deployable as a unique piece of equipment with a vendor. And we now have public safety agencies that possess these things, and they're deploying them as they see fit, where they need them, and and manage the entire process. They come onto the network. We see them as, from a network management perspective, we see them as an active node. They're woven into the network, and we understand we're able to manage through it. Again, an advancement that we probably would not have made in the enterprise space, but an advancement that is, quite frankly, key in the public safety space.
So these evolving and urgent needs lead to evolving technologies. Would it be accurate then to say that FirstNet has shifted the curve so that public safety, rather than being a late adopter of technologies, is an innovator now?
That is absolutely correct. That is absolutely correct. We're seeing innovation come out of the FirstNet program that is startling, and it has tremendous benefits. We're looking at advancing other aspects of the technology, but your point, I guess to restate your point, is public safety's gone from basically taking the technology that was given to them and utilizing it to their best ability to now taking a technology platform and innovating on that platform for their needs. And getting back to your earlier question about sharing, this stuff travels across the community very, very quickly. Public safety is a very tough customer, very tough customer. If you do exactly what you say you're going to do and you do it perfectly, they are very supportive. If you fall short by one degree, they are brutal. And so you have to have this tremendous ability to recognize what they need, when they need it, and respond at the appropriate time. Because we're there in the good times, but we've also got to be there in the bad times. And that's the real mission here, right? When you take things like the Surfside building collapse in Florida, horrible event, right? But at the end of the day, what did public safety need? They needed something which was unique. They needed Wi-Fi and Band 14 service, not in the air, not on the ground, underground. They needed to bring cameras in. They needed to bring Wi-Fi in for sensing equipment, for hazard, for gases, and also for the video, so the structural engineers could look to see how the tunnels were being built for the search and rescue. That is the stuff that you're there for, and that's the innovation that's happening. When asked how did you do this before, they would say we would dig 2 feet, take a Polaroid, walk out, show it to the engineer. They're looking at it real time. It's really amazing.
That's exciting. A final question for you, Jim. You've been involved at so many different stages in the development and the ongoing development of FirstNet. What would you say you're most proud of in terms of your contribution?
I'm most proud of the program itself, that most importantly, this country had a need. Its citizens had a need. The brave men and women that serve us had a need. And we stepped up and we solved the problem in a way that no one else in the world has solved the problem. I was talking to some of the FirstNet Authority people last week. There are 19 countries from around the world that are currently asking very detailed questions. How did you do this? They're seeing the innovation coming out. They're seeing the flexibility that's being provided to the first responders. They're hearing the stories that we're hearing. And I'm just so proud that we were able to take AT&T, the U.S. government, public safety, and develop this public-private partnership that will last a long time. public safety prior to FirstNet was 70,000 disparate licensees. It now has a network that has unique priority and preemption and network reliability features in it that is nationwide. For the first time ever, what communications capability the largest municipality, NYPD or LAPD or however you want to look at it, Frozen Sneaker, Minnesota, has the exact same capabilities. So I'm really proud that we did it nationwide and that we don't have haves and have-nots and that it's affordable and that we're giving the first responders the very best technology because we're trying to attract the brightest and best into this field. And if you don't provide them with the very best technology, it's going to be hard to get them and keep them. So that's what I'm most proud of.
Well, Jim, the impact that you and so many others have had is remarkable. And we're grateful for your contribution to this and also for joining us today to share your perspectives. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We sincerely thank you for tuning in to the story of the FirstNet Authority, an exclusive Precinct 444 series about the First Responder Network and its history. You can learn more about the FirstNet Authority by visiting firstnet.gov. Once again, a special thanks to Bill Beeman, our guest host. And as always, thank you to Christopher Mitchell for producing the series on the history of the FirstNet Authority. If you liked this series and are interested in listening to other content by Precinct 444, we invite you to check out all of our other shows on your favorite podcasting platform.
Please subscribe to Precinct 444 on your favorite podcasting platform to stay connected and to receive our latest content as soon as it drops. We would love to hear from you. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to precinct444@nleomf.org. You can help us make our content even better. The National Law Enforcement Museum is located at 444 East Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and is dedicated to telling the story of American law enforcement. We expand and enrich the relationship between law enforcement and the community through educational journeys, immersive exhibitions, and insightful programs. Find us online at lawenforcementmuseum.org and stay tuned for more podcast content from Precinct 444. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you at the precinct. We'll